Hello, I'm Rob, a producer on the Black Country Talking News, and this week's edition is for the 5th of May, 2021.
Hello, and welcome to the Black Country Talking News, brought to you by Sightloss charity, Beacon Centre. A message to our listeners who receive the Talking News on CD in the post. This remains in paper envelopes, so there's still no need to send anything back to us. We're pleased to confirm that the Talking News is now available via Alexa. All you need to do is say, "Alexa, play Black Country Talking News." Our Talking News service is also available via the following methods. Calling 01902 213 210. Visiting our website, www.beaconvision.org/talking-news, as a podcast on the Black Country Radio website, www.blackcountryradio.co.uk/podcasts, on Spotify and Apple Podcasts by simply searching Beacon Black Country Talking News and hitting the subscribe button, and on your mobile or tablet device by downloading the free British Wireless for the Blind Talking News application from your App Store. We hope you enjoy this week's edition.
Thank you, Simon. Reading this week, we have myself, Rob, writer Graham Fisher, Mina, Ed, Ashley, Helen, Simon, Liz, Christine, Ian, Angela, and of course, Flashback Roger. In this week's edition, we have an update from Beacon, some local news from the Black Country. We have the Flashback Quiz with Mina, news from West Bromwich Albion and Wolves, a Did You Know section from Flashback Roger, a look at the history of sweet making in the Black Country, the weather, an edition of Sounds of Nature, information about the Include Me Citizens Network project, and rounding all that off, one of Graham Fisher's Tales from the Barn. But first, we're calling out for superheroes. Gate is community space in Wolverhampton, in association with the COVID-19 Community Champions Scheme, are running a poster competition for children aged between 5 and 10 living across the city. The goal is to create a superhero for Wolverhampton, to help the city get the COVID-19 vaccine out to the public and keep everyone safe. The closing date for entries is Friday the 4th of June 2021. The winner will be notified on Friday the 11th of June. All entries can be emailed to Carol Mumford via gatiscommunityspace@gmail.com. Now we start as always with some local news, brought to us by Ian, Ed, Angela, Liz, and starting first, it's Christine.
More than 2,500 fines were issued by West Midlands Police for breaches of COVID-19 laws over Christmas and the start of this year, figures show. Around three quarters of all fines issued since the start of the pandemic. But the approach by police has been called into question by MPs and peers who, in calling for a review, have described the fines as muddled, discriminatory and unfair. In a report, the Joint Committee on Human Rights said the Coronavirus Act had been misunderstood and wrongly applied by police. Figures published by the National Police Chiefs Council reveal a total of 3,703 fixed penalty notices were recorded as being issued by West Midlands Police between March 27th last year and April the 18th this year. Across England and Wales, police forces have issued 110,322 fixed penalty notices under the Health Protection Coronavirus Restrictions and Regulations. However, the Joint Committee on Human Rights has criticised the system, raising concerns over the validity of the fines, the inadequacy of the review and appeals process, and the size of penalties. Harriet Harman, committee chairwoman, said, "The police have had a difficult job in policing the pandemic, and we hope that their initial approach to engage, explain and encourage before issuing fixed penalty notices will continue. Coronavirus rules have changed at least 65 times since March 2020, providing obvious challenges for police," according to the report. The report further said, "It is astonishing that the Coronavirus Act is still being misunderstood and wrongly applied by police to such an extent that every single criminal charge brought under the Act has been brought incorrectly." Of the fines in the West Midlands from March 27th last year to April 18th this year, there were 301 for failing to wear a face covering when required and 14 for breaching international travel rules. There were also 77 for breaking business regulations and 25 for holding a gathering of more than 30 people.
Almost 60% of all adults in the Black Country and West Birmingham have had their first COVID vaccine. More than 633,000 people in the region have had the first dose, but there are still eligible people who have not come forward, health bosses said. It comes as people aged 40 and over are now being invited to get their COVID-19 vaccine. Ali Roberts, Chief Nurse for Black Country and West Birmingham CCGs, said, "We are pleased to be able to invite everyone aged 40 and over to come and get their COVID-19 vaccine. We want to ensure everyone in an eligible group has had the chance to get protected, especially those who are at risk of serious illness. If you have already been offered a jab but have not taken it up, it's not too late. Please come forward and we will get you booked in. I urge all those people with underlying health conditions, carers, health and social care and care home staff who have not yet been vaccinated to contact the NHS and make an appointment now." Across the region, the NHS has now vaccinated 89% of people aged 45 and over. In addition, more than 220,000 local people have now received both doses of the vaccine. Appointments can be booked by calling 119 or online at nhs.uk/COVID-vaccination. You can also book at your local vaccination service by contacting your GP.
A shooting took place in the Black Country almost once a week during the first few months of this year, new figures show. Data from West Midlands Police showed there had been a total of 50 shootings across the area over 2019, 2020 and this year. Between January the 1st and April the 4th this year, a period of around 13 weeks, there were a total of 12 shootings across the area. A Freedom of Information request shows that the figure so far this year compares to annual figures of 19 for both 2019 and last year. In Wolverhampton, there were 5 shootings over the period this year, with 7 recorded in 2020 and 8 in 2019. It means the city has experienced the most shootings in the Black Country over the past 3 years, with 20 in total. In Sandwell, there were 6 shootings, with a further 3 last year and 6 in 2019, with 15 overall. Meanwhile, in Walsall, 1 shooting was recorded this year, with a further 3 last year and 5 in 2019, making it 9 overall. Dudley only featured once on the list, which was in 2020, when there were 6 shootings across the metropolitan borough. West Midlands Police calculated the data for the FOI request by searching for incidents with the phrase firearms discharge. There has been increasing concern that criminal groups are now arming themselves with guns as well as knives. In one recent incident, a gun was fired in a residential street in Whitmore Rennes, Wolverhampton, at 7:45 p.m. Two hooded people were seen running down Lloyd Street before one pointed and shot a gun before they both ran away. Video emerged of the shooting, which damaged a car in the street. The drama played out as families watched from their homes. One resident said, "We are all worried on the street now, as knives are one thing, but guns are next level, and they look like kids."
As restrictions have eased further and non-essential businesses reopen, people of Wolverhampton are reminded to use the NHS COVID-19 app when they're out and about in the city. The free NHS COVID-19 app is a vital part of controlling the spread of coronavirus. It offers a range of tools to support and protect people, including venue check-in, contact tracing, and useful information. As more places reopen across the city, and businesses and organisations are encouraged to support contact tracing, hospitality venues that have reopened with an outdoor service will ask everyone to use the check-in app. Previously, just one member of each group was asked to check in, but under new guidelines, every customer is asked to check in either via the app or by leaving their contact details with staff. The app will also let you know if you have been near other users who have tested positive for the virus, or if you have visited a venue where you may have come into close contact with someone with coronavirus. As well as this, it contains a coronavirus symptom checker, and people with symptoms can use it to book a test. It also has a countdown timer for anyone self-isolating. John Denley, Wolverhampton's Director of Public Health, said, "The NHS COVID-19 app is a vital tool in controlling the spread of the virus as we begin reopening our city. I urge everyone to download the free app onto their phones to help protect yourself and others around you. It's the quickest way of knowing whether you have been at risk of catching the virus from someone else." As restrictions are eased and more places reopen, the app is being widely used across the city to check in to venues, so everyone in a group should be prepared to do so. Having the app on your phone will make the process a whole lot quicker. The NHS COVID-19 app is free and has been downloaded more than 20 million times from the Google and Apple app stores. It does not share personal data or track you and uses low energy Bluetooth, so will not drain your battery. For more information about the app, visit covid19.nhs.uk.
Major vehicle collisions in the West Midlands have dropped by nearly a third, according to a new report. West Midlands Police say there has been a 30% decrease in people being killed or seriously injured in collisions involving cyclists, motorbikes, pedestrians and cars across the West Midlands since 2018. The figures show that there were 1,011 killed or seriously injured casualties throughout 2018, with 939 during 2019 and a further reduction to 717 for 2020. The work to cut collision casualties across the West Midlands has also helped to reduce the strain on the NHS during the COVID pandemic. The Road Harm Prevention Team carries out a variety of operations using plainclothes and uniformed officers. The unit works alongside neighbourhood policing teams, Transport for West Midlands, local authorities, other emergency services and third sector agencies to help keep the roads safe. Sergeant John Butler, who leads the team, says, "Dangerous and illegal driving can have serious or even fatal consequences. We know the long-lasting impact it can have on communities, so we've invested in extra officers to enable us to increase our activities to maintain the safety of vulnerable road users and pedestrians. We're both enforcing the law and educating around the dangers of reckless behaviour on our roads. Even during the unprecedented last year, we've continued to see a regular volume of road users. Hopefully we'll continue to see a cut in collisions over the coming years as a result of the ongoing efforts between us and our partners."
Three more local news bulletins coming up, but now it's time for our weekly update from Beacon.
Hi everyone, it's Helen from the Beacon Centre. Well, welcome to May. Yes, incredibly, the fifth month of 2021 is upon us. And while COVID-19 means that Wales is still constantly changing, hopefully you know that the support you can get from Beacon remains a constant. Take our lifestyle team, for example. They've completed more than 200 virtual activity sessions already this year. So if you haven't joined them yet, why not make May the month to do it? If you'd like to find out how to join Beacon's classes, email Kim Williams via kwilliams@beaconvision.org or call 01902 880111. Now, here's a bit of a riddle for you. What does a Mary Berry cookbook, a Star Wars plush toy, an Aston Villa League Cup final programme, and a pair of Nike trainers have in common? You can find them all on our eBay store, that's what. If you want to bag yourself a bargain without having to leave your sofa, then why not head to our online store now at www.ebay.co.uk/str/beaconcharityshop. And don't forget that every purchase will help someone with sight loss. If you're a bargain hunter and you've been heading out to the shops, then why not head to our Wolverhampton Clearance Centre, which has launched an amazing 75% off sale on all clothes. You'll find us on Lower Walsall Street and we're open 9:30am till 5pm Mondays to Saturdays and 10am to 2pm on Sundays. We're COVID-19 secure, so you can shop with confidence as well. Don't forget your mask. Now, did you mark International Guide Dog Day on April the 28th? We love all of our four-legged friends who visit our centre. They're as much a part of a Beacon family as you, our members. Did you know that the bond between dogs and visually impaired people goes back further than you might think? One of the earliest depictions of a dog leading someone with sight loss dates back to the 1st century. It's just incredible the support they provide. And talking about support, we'd like to give a very big thank you to the company Screwfix. They have funded some work which is currently being carried out to ensure our centre is even more inclusive for people with sight loss. Last week, we had some of our external handrails painted bright yellow to enhance their visibility. Lastly this week, we want to know, what were some of the things that concerned you when you first received a sight loss diagnosis? One of the most common questions our expert sight loss advisors get asked is, can I still read my newspaper? We understand, it's the small things that make the difference after all. The good news is, whatever your sight loss condition, there will be a way of keeping up with the latest news. Whether it's something simple like changing your lighting or switching to sight loss friendly audio options like you're doing right now. Whatever your query, we can help. Get in touch, call 01902 880 111 Monday to Friday or email referrals@beaconvision.org. That's it for this week. Hopefully, I'll be back to catch up with you again soon.
Cheers, Helen. Thanks for that. Coming up next, we have some more local news.
Lower fares and a weekly contactless cap on buses in the West Midlands has been described as brilliant news by the Transport Secretary. National Express West Midlands has made the move to roll back the price of its daily and weekly fares for when restrictions ease on June the 21st. And a new weekly contactless ticket price cap will be introduced across the network in June to help simplify the process of paying for a ticket. The move has received the backing of Transport Secretary Grant Shapps, who visited the bus company's garage based on Pensnet Trading Estate. Mr. Shapps said, "It's not often you can spread some brilliant news, some good news like this, and I'm here to celebrate the idea, which starts when lockdown ends." Contactless is per day capped, and brilliantly it's going to cap it off on a week fare as well, so you won't be able to pay more than £15 a week. And actually, the only other place where this exists is in London. This is the first place outside London to do this. I've got no doubt at all, if you come back in a year's time, we'll find there will be people travelling who perhaps haven't done before. I've been inside the buses and they're lovely. You would want to be in there. There's Wi-Fi and they're beautiful machines and clean. The contactless weekly ticket price capping means people will be able to travel as much as they like, with people showing their contactless bank card or the banking app on their phone to the bus ticket machine each time they get on. At the end of 7 days, they'll be charged no more than the cost of a weekly ticket, no matter how many journeys they make. The bus company is cutting the price of the peak day ticket from £4.60 to £4 on June the 21st, when restrictions are expected to ease, and the price of a weekly ticket will drop from £17.50 to £15. It is expected the average commuter will save over £130 a year on bus travel as a result of the fares being cut, with the cost of a child ticket becoming £2 a day, down from £2.50.
The West Midlands has been revealed to have the highest rate of fuel poverty in England. New government statistics show that more than one in six households in the region are trapped in cold homes. They show that 17.5% in the region can't heat their homes affordably, compared to the England average of 13.4%. Of the 10 local authority areas with the highest rates of fuel poverty in England, half are in the West Midlands region, including Wolverhampton, which is fifth in the list, at 21.1%, Sandwell in 7th at 20.9%, and 10th placed Walsall at 19.4%. The charity National Energy Action is warning that more help is needed locally and nationally to address the physical and mental health impacts of cold homes, Adam Scorer, Chief Executive at National Energy Action, said that more than one in six households in the region cannot afford to keep their homes warm. They are likely to be living in cold, damp and unsafe properties. It makes illnesses such as respiratory and circulatory diseases worse and takes a toll on their mental health. While those affected are hit the hardest, it also places an avoidable strain on local health and social services. Unaffordable bills are a struggle all year, but we know that when it is cold outside, people will turn to dangerous ways to cope. We know that people feel they need to rely on unserviced heating appliances despite the risk of carbon monoxide poisoning, fires, or even explosions. People will be living in one room, going to bed for large parts of the day and relying on candles to keep their bills lower. Warm homes should be a basic right for all, but in the West Midlands, they are a pressing local priority.
A partnership between a homeless charity and the NHS has helped offer the COVID-19 vaccine to vulnerable people. A dedicated pop-up clinic was held at the Good Shepherd Charity in Wolverhampton City Centre, with 154 people coming forward to be vaccinated. Speaking at the clinic, Paul Burns, Housing First support worker for the Good Shepherd, said, "This is helping us to help them change their lives. The turnout at the clinic has been marvellous, and I'm glad so many people have received their vaccine today." The clinic, run by local GP Dr. Cam Ahmed and his team, mainly gave out second doses of the vaccine following a successful first clinic in February. Dr. Ahmed said, "Homelessness and poor health all too often go hand in hand, which means homeless people are particularly vulnerable to the harmful effects of this virus. Working with charities like Good Shepherd and vaccinating local homeless people is a big step that we can take to protect some of our most vulnerable residents. The team and I are delighted to have this opportunity to make a difference." Sally Roberts, Chief Nursing Officer for Black Country and West Birmingham Clinical Commissioning Group and local vaccination programme lead, said the clinic was a great example of how partnership working can make a big difference. She said, "People who are homeless suffer from some of the biggest health inequalities in our society, so we work closely with support charities across the region to ensure homeless people can access essential healthcare services like vaccination. We're clear that nobody is going to get left behind in our drive to vaccinate our most vulnerable and get everyone protected from COVID-19.
A community group has launched plans to transform a derelict site into a place for people to grow food and teach children wildlife conservation. St Thomas's Community Association wants to develop land between Lupin Road, Hollyhock Road, Cypress Road and Buns Lane in Dudley. The site has remained untouched since at least 1963 and has recently become derelict, overgrown and littered with rubbish. It led to residents being asked for their thoughts on transforming the site, with an overwhelming number showing support for the plans. Demand at nearby Jasmine Road Community Gardens for such activities is high. Donna Haddock, a trustee and project leader at Jasmine Road Community Gardens, said, "We are excited about the plans and pleased to be working with St Thomas's to transform this site. This will be a good addition to the work we do and will be something that is very much needed in the area that involves local people, children, schools and other groups." Dudley councillor Shokat Ali, who is chairman of the community group, said, "We have had this site cleared of lorry loads of fly-tipped items around 15 years ago and a barrier installed to prevent further dumping. We have been working closely with Jasmine Road Community Gardens on how to bring this site into use for the benefit of local people. Consultation has shown overwhelming support from local people who cannot wait to get involved, taking forward these exciting plans. People will have an opportunity to grow fresh fruit, vegetables, flowers and plants on their doorstep and create a space for enjoying the natural environment. I am delighted that works to clear the site clearance marks a new chapter in the history of this land."
Wolves owner Fosun is sending 100,000 face masks to Mumbai in India to help with the fight against the coronavirus surge in the country. Another of the Chinese group's businesses, Galand Pharma, is shipping 150 ventilators made by Sweden's Brias Medical to India. Fosun said, "We are proud of the two companies, which are all from the Fosun family. Stay strong, India, we are with you." Fosun Pharma has also teamed up with BioNTech to develop the mRNA COVID-19 vaccine. The group has provided PPE and mechanical equipment around the world where it has businesses to help in the pandemic. Fosun recently reported a fall in profits and turnover for last year as it was hit by the coronavirus pandemic. Revenue was £15.1 billion from £16.2 billion a year earlier, with net profit down from £1.69 billion to £890 million for the group. Wolves, which Fosun bought in 2016 for £30 million, is part of the Happiness business unit. Fosun has already deployed 3 million pieces of medical supplies to support the frontline battle against the pandemic.
Now we head over to Mina, who asked us the questions for this week's quiz.
Hello and welcome to the Flashback Quiz. All the answers you need can be found later in Flashback Rogers Did You Know feature. But for now, here are your questions. Are you ready? Question 1. Which letter of the alphabet never appears in the name of any US state? Question 2. What company uses a bomb-shaped robot? Question 3. If walnuts and cashews aren't actually nuts, what are they? Question 4. For what purpose was the little pocket in jeans originally intended? Question 5. What happens to turkeys when they get scared or excited? And question 6. What number would you have to count to before you see the letter A? As always, I'll be back to reveal the answers later in the show. But for now, good luck!
Thanks for those questions, Mina. I'll give those a little ponder. Now we head to another section of local news. And starting us off, it's Ian.
A suspected wartime bomb, which brought traffic chaos to Wolverhampton, turned out to be a harmless practice device. The device was found in the canal off Wolverhampton's Ring Road, leading to traffic gridlock as police cordoned off the area. The A4150 Ring Road was heavily congested, as were Stafford Street, Birmingham Road, Wensfield Road, Horsley Fields and Bilston Street, while the bus station was also cordoned off for a few hours. The Explosive Ordnance Disposal Team was called to attend the scene after the discovery was made in the canal near the city's railway station at around 3 p.m. last Friday. However, on closer inspection, the bomb was found to be a concrete-filled practice device and was in no danger of causing an explosion, leading to roads and the bus station being reopened. A spokesman for West Midlands Police said the device was recovered from the canal and found to be a concrete-filled practice device. There was no threat of an explosion. The cordons were removed and road closures lifted shortly after 6 p.m. The device discovery comes only weeks after a suspected mortar round was found in a Wolverhampton canal. The area around the canal network in Horsley Fields was closed off as bomb disposal experts were called on Easter Monday. The Explosive Ordnance Disposal Team was then called and a controlled explosion carried out.
Tipton and Coseley Building Society is celebrating 120 years helping homeowners in the West Midlands. It was on May 1st in 1901 that a meeting was arranged in Owen Street, Tipton, and it was agreed people would pay a subscription each week to join. Today, the headquarters remain in Tipton and it has four branches, its head office in Owen Street, Tipton, Coseley, Sedgley and Bilston. The Tipton and District Permanent Benefit Building Society has grown steadily over the years to have reached more than £400 million in assets in 2020. Society Chief Executive Richard Newton, who has been in post since 2013, said it was sad that because of the coronavirus pandemic, today's milestone could not be celebrated as had originally been hoped. Mr. Newton said that the Tipton, which employs 90 people across its branches, was looking at holding an event later in the year instead. Currently, about half of its head office staff are still working remotely. In 2020, the Society achieved mortgage book growth of 7.2%, with gross mortgage lending of over £77 million during the year. Savers increased their investments by more than £7 million and pre-tax profit was £1.1 million. During the year, the Tipton became the first building society to launch a mobile app that enables new customers and existing members to open, view and manage saving accounts on the go, while mortgage customers can view their balance too. Mr. Newton said, "Our staff are the vital ingredient in our continuing success."
A proposed Black Country housing scheme, which residents feared would intensify antisocial behaviour problems that they suffer, has been rejected. Developers had hoped to construct 10 houses, a bungalow and a communal garden on two parcels of land on Fordraft Street in Cradley and had received support from Dudley Council planning officers who recommended approval. But the proposal was rejected by members of the authority's Development Control Committee due to concerns about a loss of parking hitting shops on the nearby high street and a loss of green space for residents. During the consultation period, objectors said the development would ruin the high street and also feared problems including drug dealing, graffiti and littering would increase. Previously, a plan for a mixture of apartments and houses earmarked sparked even more fury amongst the community. Paul Bedard, who spoke on behalf of the developer, said, "We have tried to work together in a positive manner to best meet the needs of the local community on this potential development. This site provides us with a great opportunity to improve the area, address long-standing issues and provide much-needed affordable housing. The consultation process has been a big positive and listened to local opinion and changed the proposal as a result. However, these changes have put us on the limit of financial viability of what we can deliver. Historically, this site has been unviable for developers to build on, hence why it continues to sit empty and provide nuisance for the local community."
More Wolverhampton libraries are now set to reopen. Bilston, Wharstones and Wensfield libraries have joined Wolverhampton Central Library in offering control browsing and computer use for the first time in more than a year. Capacity at each library is limited to enable social distancing and ensure the safety of staff and customers, with people required to book a 30-minute session in advance. Customers must be a member of the library service to book a session. Robert Johnson, City Librarian, said the reopening of Central Library last Monday went very smoothly, and following the opening of more libraries this week, we plan to offer control browsing and computer access at our libraries in Finchfield and Technor from next week.
Lidl is set to open a new store at Maryhill. The supermarket has purchased the former Ultimate Outdoor site at Maryhill Retail Park, which has been vacant since March last year. When the store opens, it will create around 40 full and part-time jobs. A spokesperson for Lidl said, "We can confirm that we have purchased the site and secured planning permission to bring a new Lidl store to Maryhill Retail Park. We look forward to investing in Dudley and creating more job opportunities for the local area. We would like to take this opportunity to thank everyone for their support so far." The German discount chain has not yet confirmed an opening date, but has said that they look forward to starting construction in due course. Currently, the closest Lidl supermarket to Maryhill is on Lower High Street in Cradley Heath. It comes after the popular supermarket announced in January it would be opening 50 new stores across the country this year.
Now we hear from Ashley from Midland Mencap, who has us information about the Include Me Citizens Network project.
Hi, my name is Ashley and I'm the Citizens Network Connector at Midland Mencap, and today I'd just like to introduce to you a new project that we're working on alongside the West Midlands Combined Authority and the Activity Alliance that I'd love for you to be part of. Did you know that the West Midlands has the highest level of physical inactivity than anywhere else in England? Also, one in five people within this region either have a disability or long-term health condition, and a staggering 49% of that one in five does little to no physical activity throughout the week, and that needs to change. Include Me Citizens Network is a social movement that's designed to be a user-led voice for people with a disability, long-term health condition, as well as their parents, carers and other family members, to work in collaboration with the West Midlands Combined Authority and help encourage the positive changes that are needed to improve accessibility and ultimately enable our minority groups to develop a lifelong enjoyment and participation of physical activity and sport in a way that's fully accessible for them. Living with a disability myself and having an absolute love and passion for physical activity and sport, I'm well aware of the day-to-day challenges being physically active can entail due to limited accessibility. And that's why I think becoming involved with the Citizens Network is the very first step in allowing us all to develop a louder voice and encourage the changes that are needed to make the West Midlands the best it possibly can be for accessibility. And what better time to start taking action and make our voices louder than in the midst of a pandemic when everyone is planning and preparing for a new normal? Let's make that new normal more accessible for us together. If this is something that you'd like to get involved in, you can email me at ashley.jones@midlandmencap.org.uk. And Ashley is spelled A-S-H-L-E-I-G-H. Alternatively, you can call me on 07912-269-035. Thank you for listening today and I look forward to hearing from you soon.
Thanks for informing us about that project, Ashley. Now we have our final block of local news. And starting us off, it's Ed.
New jobs will be created when a new drive-through restaurant opens in Wensfield. Canadian chain Tim Hortons is set to open at Bentley Bridge, offering coffee and donuts, while dine-in seating for up to 128 guests. The new restaurant will create more than 40 jobs for the community. It will offer a combination of full-time and part-time roles, with progression and training opportunities. The announcement also forms part of the brand's plan to create over 2,000 jobs across the country, bringing Tim Hortons restaurants to every major town and city by 2022. Set to open its doors this summer, customers can expect coffee, freshly baked donuts and Timbits around the clock, as well as breakfast, lunch and evening meal options, including hot sandwiches and wraps. Kevin Hyde, Chief Commercial Officer of Tim Hortons in the UK, said, "Having successfully opened our first restaurant in the West Midlands back in 2018, it brings me great pleasure to announce another opening within the region. We've all always seen huge enthusiasm and support from our guests in Birmingham and know the wider community are keen for more. Wensfield has excellent transport links to Wolverhampton, Warsaw and Dudley, so we're excited for locals to have the opportunity to fall in love with our brand. Our staff make the Tim Hortons experience so special and we pride ourselves on the unique progression and training opportunities available. We look forward to recruiting for a variety of exciting part-time and full-time roles, and we will be accepting applications via our website."
Himley Hall was forced to quickly close its gates after a flock of adventurous sheep wandered into the grounds. Visitors and staff were said to be baffled as the flock enjoyed a leisurely stroll and munched on the grass at the Dudley Beauty Spot last Thursday. It is believed that the 250-strong flock of sheep and lambs got into the park from a neighbouring field when electric fencing broke down. Staff on site quickly got into shepherd mode and rounded up the woolly animals and returned them to safety. The park had to be briefly closed to visitors in order to protect the sheep and their lambs, who workers said particularly seemed to enjoy walking among the recently blooming bluebells. No sheep were harmed and the park was back open again shortly after 9 a.m. once they had been returned to their field. Tracy Rees, the site manager, said, "It wasn't quite what we were expecting when we turned up for work this morning, but then again, every day here is different." The sheep seemed to enjoy their time grazing on the lawn and returned home with good grace. I think they wanted to get in before the bank holiday weekend to make the most of our beautiful site and the bluebells, which are really coming into their own. Sheep permitting, the park is open every day from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m.
A car that played a starring role in the latest series of Line of Duty has been sold to a fan of the show at a Black Country dealership. The Mazda MX-5 RF, driven by DI Kate Fleming on the hit BBC drama, had been on sale at Brindley Mazda in Wolverhampton since the middle of April. And now the 2020 sports car, which sells for around £30,000 new, has been snapped up for an undisclosed price. Brindley Mazda General Manager Jason Devi said the car had been purchased by the dealership as part of a fleet of used cars, and they hadn't realised what they'd bought until they saw the episode. He said, "When cars are finished with, for whatever reason, whether they are company cars or a demonstrator, or whatever other reason, Mazda UK will advertise the cars to the dealers to allow them to buy new cars. We've been the biggest purchaser from Mazda's UK's fleet programme, with so many cars from there, and we bought the car because of the model and because it's an iconic sports car. We didn't know it had been used in filming of the show until we saw it, so it was a nice surprise to find that out." Mr. Devi said, while the dealership had used the show to promote the car on social media, its role on Line of Duty had not influenced its price. He said, "We've had the MX-5 Owners Club come down and take pictures, and fans of the show came to take a look. We put out a post on Facebook that it was a bit of TV drama history for us." Mr. Devi said the car had been put on sale a couple of weeks ago and had just been bought by a fan of the show who wanted a Mazda and found out the car was on sale at the dealership. He said, "It's all positive for us at the dealership, as we've looked after this car and it's going to someone who likes the show and is over the moon to get the car."
Staff and residents at a care home in Wolverhampton have taken part in a litter pick as part of the Captain Sir Tom Moore Challenge. The challenge was issued by Sir Tom's family to commemorate what would have been his 101st birthday. Activity coordinators Michelle Jones and Kerry Kenton, who work at the Methodist Home Association's Waterside House Residential Dementia Care Home, decided to carry out a major litter pick around the towpath of the Wensfield Canal after being shocked by the amount of discarded rubbish in the area. Joining Michelle on the litter pick was fellow activity coordinator Kerry Kenton, aged 49, from Wolverhampton, home chaplain Dawn Ellis, aged 53, from Bilston, and home domestic Natasha Bart, aged 34, from Wensfield. Michelle, aged 39, from Wensfield, said, "Weather permitting, we hoped to take 95-year-old May Barnett and 84-year-old Sheila Powers on the litter pick. We hoped to each collect 100 pieces of litter to help clear as much rubbish as possible. I decided it would be a good idea to do a litter pick after visiting the area for a walk with the residents. It was sad to see such a lot of litter surrounding the area, and particularly around the nests of birds. Some of the residents were very distressed by what they saw, and I suggested it would be something we could do together as part of the Sir Captain Tom Moore 100 Challenge. The challenge is for people to carry out something 100 times in his memory, and we felt this was the ideal activity. The residents know of Sir Tom because they often saw him on television, and he was an inspiration to many people."
A Banksy-style mural painted on the side of a pub wall has got people doing a double take. At first glance, it appears that owner Eddie Morton is precariously balanced at the top of a 20-foot ladder, painting the side of Katie Fitzgerald's in Stourbridge. But the eye-catching painting is in fact an illusion, and all part of a makeover at the long-standing site, which Eddie, who owns the pub with wife Trina, said is to become more events-orientated. He said this mural is the beginning of the renewal of this venue and represents our community of artists. He said after we'd taken most of the pub signs down, we decided we wanted to do something with the walls. My wife Trina comes from Erdington, and said there had been a famous painting there of a man on a ladder, and said she wanted the same. It was done by local artist David Johnson in 3 days. He said, "We're a community of artists here, and it represents what we are all about, as we have the mural and other people in to paint the walls as part of our refurbishment. We have been here for 21 years, and we want to make sure that our look represents our community and this venue."
Now it's time to hear from Flashback Roger, who asked for us some more amazing facts.
Hello again, everyone. I hope that you are all well and that you've been behaving yourselves this week. Well, for a little, anyway. There are some little gems in here this week, I think. Some will make you smile, others will make you think, and some that I hope will surprise you. So, without further ado, I shall begin with this one. Did you know that there's only one letter that doesn't appear in any US state name? Can you guess the answer to this random fact? Well, you'll find a Z in Arizona, a J in New Jersey, and even two X's, New Mexico and Texas, but not a single Q. Samsung tests their phone's durability with a bomb-shaped robot. Well, who'd have thought it? Samsung did. Because people stash their phones in their back pockets all the time, which is why Samsung created a robot that is shaped like a bomb. And yes, it even wears jeans to sit on the phones to make sure they can take the pressure. And peanuts aren't technically nuts, they're legumes. According to Merriam-Webster's Dictionary of Definitions, a nut is only a nut if it's a hard-shelled dry fruit or seed with a separable rind or shell and internal kernel. That means walnuts, almonds, cashews and pistachios aren't nuts either. They're all seeds. And who'd have thought that turkeys can blush? When turkeys are scared or excited, like when the males see a female they're interested in, the pale skin on their head and neck turns bright red, blue or white. The flap of skin over their beaks is called a snood, and that also reddens. The original jeans only had 4 pockets. That tiny one, plus 2 more on the front and just 1 in the back. That tiny pocket in jeans was designed to store pocket watches. Of course, they were invented long before the coming of mobile phones, so nowadays there are 2 at the back, and they fit the Samsung robot's backside a real treat. Now here's one that'll get you thinking and reaching for a notepad to check it out. There are no numbers before 1000 that contain the letter A, but there are plenty of E's, I's, O's, U's and Y's, so get scribbling and see if it's true. And finally for this week, Europeans became scared of eating tomatoes in the 18th century. It's thought that one Hernan Cortes bought the seeds back in 1519 with the intent of the fruits being used only ornamentally in gardens. But by the 1700s, aristocrats started eating tomatoes, but they were convinced that the fruits were poison because people would die after eating them. In reality, it was the acidity from the tomatoes that brought out the lead in the pewter plates. So really, they died of lead poisoning. Well, so there you have it, folks. I've enjoyed this week's lesson. I hope that you have, and that you do well in the quiz later. But for now, I'll just say bye for now. Enjoy yourselves. Ta-ra!
Thanks, Roger. Now we head over to Mina with the weather forecast for the week ahead.
The weather for this week ahead starts off wet but will become more settled as the week progresses. Temperatures will be hovering around 14 to 16 degrees. UV levels are expected to be moderate throughout the week. The sunrise and sunset times are 5:19 a.m. for the sunrise and 8:51 p.m. for the sunset. For Friday 7th of May we have sunny intervals and a gentle breeze, with a maximum temperature of 13 degrees. On Saturday 8th of May, we have light rain and a moderate breeze, with a maximum temperature of 16 degrees. On Sunday 9th of May and Monday 10th of May, we have light rain showers and a moderate breeze, with a maximum temperature of 16 degrees. And on Tuesday, 11th of May through to Thursday, 13th of May, we have sunny intervals and a gentle breeze with a maximum temperature of 16 degrees. So that's your forecast for the week. As always, enjoy the weather.
Thanks for that weather update, Mina. Now we're going to head over to Sounds of Nature, which this week is about the lesser-spotted woodpecker. The lesser-spotted woodpecker is the smallest and least common of the UK's three species of woodpecker. It is most often found in the tops of trees, where it creeps along branches in search of insects. Its drumming is much quieter and less vigorous than that of the great spotted woodpecker. Its presence is often only given away by this or their call. The lesser spotted woodpecker is small in size, being not much bigger than a house sparrow. Males are black and white, with their red crown cap, and females are plain black and white. They both have a distinctive white ladder marking down their black back. This recording was made by Lawrence Shove and was made available by the British Library. Coming up next, we have Ian with the sport.
Hello, I'm Ian, and here's your latest football news. Played out amid an almighty downpour and no fans at the Hawthorns, Monday's Black Country Derby is not one that will live long in the memory. A point is no good to Sam Allardyce's Albion as they stare relegation in the face. But for Nuno Espirito Santo's Wolves, they at least avoided the dreaded feeling of another loss to their fiercest rivals. They are certainly the more satisfied group coming out of this encounter, which, come the end, was blighted by an absurd amount of rain. Make no mistake about it, the elements were very much at play. Dark clouds hung over the ground, and the rain was relentless throughout the 90 minutes. It was weather befitting a bank holiday Monday, and even more so a proper Black Country battle. Nuno and Allardyce bumped fists before kickoff as the liquidator blasted through the stadium speakers. And once the game got going, Wolves captain Connor Cody's instructions could only be faintly heard because of the constant rain. Already sodden, there were, unsurprisingly, a few instances of players losing their footing in the early exchanges. Albion looked slightly more assured. Both sides, though, kept things at a pretty modest pace. Nuno stood with his arms folded as his charges began to increase the tempo on the half-hour mark, Nelson Semedo and Vitinha going close. Allardyce, meanwhile, felt the need to change things, with the disheartened Dara O'Shea taking a slow walk off. Large parts of the first half were slow and tedious, the absence of supporters keenly felt. But Wolves, with a little bit of luck after a free-flowing, intricate move, opened the scoring. The Baggies all stood perplexed as Kyle Bartley's attempted clearance cannoned off Fabio Silva's standing leg and looped over the helpless Sam Johnston. Club record signing Silva, just as he did in the reverse fixture and not caring a jot how it went in, celebrated with a massive knee slide while Nuno hugged his backroom team. For the start of the second period, neither manager made a change. However, there was a switch in referee. Paul Tierney had pulled his calf, and Mike Dean, originally down as fourth official, stepped in. Albion stepped things up too. Sammy Lee was animated on the touchline as Conor Gallagher could have, and really should have, equalised. Rui Patricio puffed out his chest after a superb reaction save to deny the Chelsea low knee. The Baggies' persistence eventually paid off, though, as Mbaye Diagne escaped the attention of Romain Saïss and duly tucked away a free header. Easy as you like, and from Wolves' perspective, old habits dying hard. In response, Nuno turned to his bench, and namely Daniel Podence, while Allardyce, having been seated for most of the match, screamed for more intensity from his men. But going into the final 15 minutes, the rain came crashing down at an almost unfathomable rate. It had drowned out the on-pitch noise by this point and affected the action. Rayan Aynouri, one of three Wolves players currently observing Ramadan, limped off and was replaced by Max Kilman. Saïs, another of those, was moving uncomfortably as well, with the ball no longer bouncing as it usually would. It made for a less eventful end, and ultimately the spoils were shared. As the sun finally came out, Albion's disappointment was clear to see. Only a win would do. For Wolves, it could have been better, of course, but after the trouncing at the hands of Burnley last time out, they will take it and move forward.
Thanks for that update, Ian. Now we have a feature from the Black Country Living Museum about the history of sweets.
Nothing brings back memories of childhood quite like the taste of a favourite sweet. The sugary coating, the sweet and sour taste of rhubarb and custard, pear drops, or licking kali off a lolly. Today, we are delving into the history of sweet making inside T. Cook's Sweet Shop.
Hello and welcome to Sugar Plums and Sherbet. My name's Jean and I'm going to tell you a little bit about Black Country sweet making. In the Black Country, we don't call our sweet shops, we call them suk shops. Now, suk is the word for sweets in Black Country dialect because children in Victorian times would suck on the hard-boiled sweets that were made. Then, because they didn't have a lot of money, they would then save that sweet for another day. And shop is shop. So suk shop is the sweets that the children would have enjoyed, albeit just for a very short amount of time. Sweet making in the Black Country was mainly, in Victorian times, the hard-boiled sweets. And to make the hard-boiled sweets, you would firstly need a copper pan. The man was usually the one who did the sweet making, and the woman would sell the sweets. But the man would start by putting in sugar, followed by glucose, and then he would boil that up to a temperature of 300 degrees Fahrenheit, or about 150 Celsius these days. And in the copper pan, which was extremely heavy, he would wait and wait until it bubbled up, until it got almost to the surface. When it reached that temperature, he would pour it out onto a heated table. That kept the mixture warm while he added the things to make them into sweets. Colours in Victorian times were not the best. In fact, a doctor wrote in the Lancet in late Victorian times that he did not approve of the use of certain things or poisons within the sweet making realm. For red, they started by using red lead. Red lead, of course, is extremely dangerous. Following that, for red, they used this. This is cochineal. And cochineal is squashed beetle's blood. There we have it. At this point, you would groan, you would think, oh no, how can they do it? But yes, that's what they used. For blue, it would be mercury. Extremely dangerous again. One of the worst colours of all would be green. Green sweets were made with arsenic poison. Flavours in Victorian times in the Black Country would have been mainly what was grown in the local gardens. One of the most popular sweets of the time, and is actually quite popular today, is dandelion and burdock. Very popular. There are other things you can think of right away, such as mint. They would use mint from the garden. But locally grown flowers, such as coltsfoot, whorehound, all those are very popular sweets at that time.
From the 1800s, this was the dawn of a new era for confectionery manufacturers, assisted by the rise of the Industrial Revolution and mass production. British sugar beet became more commonly used than costly sugar cane, which had to be imported. The cost of setting up confectionery businesses was relatively inexpensive and could even be set up in the backyard at home. Sweets were now not only a luxury for the rich, but available for the working classes too. An average of 33 bags of sugar was eaten per person in Britain by the 1900s. Soldiers in the First World War were said to have had very poor teeth because of this.
The sweet maker would use a drop roller machine, such as the one we have here, and choose the rollers for the shape of sweet that he wanted. The drop rollers themselves, the ones that we have here, were made in Rochdale by a firm called Luke Collier and Son in early Victorian times, from around 1835. And they are brass, he was a brass founder. And two of these would fit onto the machine, such as the one here we have set up. And the mix, then, the small amounts that he put into small balls, would go onto this side of the drop roller. He would turn the handle. The mix would go through while it was still hot, because the mix must be hot, otherwise the sweet making doesn't work because it would be too brittle. The shape on the roller is pushed into the hot sugar. It comes out in a strip, which is then placed on the surface and allowed to cool for about 5 minutes. Once the sweets have gone hard, it takes about 4 to 5 minutes, you would drop them into this, which is a riddle. It's an old-fashioned sieve, and my father regularly asked me to do his garden soil with one of these. So the sweets would go into here, shake off the excess so that you only have the sweet shape in there, and then for about 30 seconds they're put over steam, and that allows us to cover the sweets in sugar so that they don't stick together. And that was the last part of the sweet making. Once that was done, they would then have the sweets ready for sale. You don't see bags like this very often, do you? This is a cone-shaped brown greaseproof paper bag. Do you hear it? And in that, in the early part of the 20th century and late Victorian times, they would put 3, 4, 5 small sweets. They would fold the bag over, and that was a treat for children. That was called a penny twist. Children generally in the Black Country didn't have much money, so when they wanted a sweet, they knew that if they went to Mr. Cook's store, knocked on it and said, "Hello, can we help you today?" that if they got some work from Mr. Cook, their reward would be 2 or 3 nice small boiled sweets that he'd made, which they would suck and save. So that was the way children managed to get sweets in Victorian times in this area.
We do hope this hasn't put you off your sweets and has given you some interesting stories to get your teeth into. Thank you for joining us.
Now we head over to Mina, who has for us the answers to this week's quiz.
Here are your answers for this week's flashback quiz. Are you ready? Question 1. Which letter of the alphabet never appears in the name of any US state? And the answer is the letter Q. Question 2. What company uses a bomb-shaped robot? And the answer here is Samsung. Question 3. If walnuts and cashews aren't actually nuts, what are they? And the answer here is, they're classified as seeds. Question 4. For what purpose was the little pocket in jeans originally intended? And the answer here is, for a pocket watch. Question 5. What happens to turkeys when they get scared or excited? I love this answer. They blush. And finally, question 6. What number would you have to count to before you see the letter A? And the answer is 1,000. How did you do? Really well, I hope. But if not, don't worry. There's always another chance to have a go next week. Now, to end this week's edition of the Black Country Talking News, it's time to visit Graham Fisher to hear one of his tales from the barn.
Hello. Parting, as the bard suggested, is such sweet sorrow. Erudite undoubtedly, yet an example of the oxymorons and grammatical paradoxes that Shakespeare frequently employed for emphasis and contrast. Here, at the end of the balcony scene in Romeo and Juliet, her use of sweet sorrow is indicative both of her emotional turmoil and anticipation of the next time the lovers will meet. Tragic as the tale ultimately concludes, Juliet was at least able to entertain the expectation that they would. I, too, enjoyed a relationship for which parting was sweet sorrow. Twice I have said a sorrowful goodbye, but alas, on this second occasion, I am saddened beyond measure to know there will be no sweet reunion. What distinguishes this particular association is that the object of my affections was made of metal and boasted a displacement just shy of 300 metric tons. Oliver Cromwell, no, not him, was a riveted steel Dutch freight barge of 1922 vintage that was converted at Sharpness in 1993 as a Mississippi-style paddle-wheel hotel boat. Accommodation with ensuite facilities for 44 guests, plus crew cabins and office space, was complemented by a fully equipped galleon restaurant, bar, dance floor, viewing decks, and all the attendant facilities for offering pampered passengers a leisurely cruise of up to 6 days along the Gloucester and Sharpness Canal and the River Severn. Protruding a whopping 138.5 feet rearwards from the nose, 22 feet across the hips, and standing way over 20 feet tall in flat heels, MV Oliver Cromwell, the MV denoting motor vessel, was the largest of her type afloat in the UK, and only seemed to just fit in some of the river locks if everyone breathed in at the same time. Truly a combination of awesome beast and gracious lady, if ever there was. The story goes that the original owners who recommissioned the hotel variant chose the name Duke of Gloucester. When the royal household objected, they retaliated with a gloriously anarchic reference to the Lord Protector. Although English Holiday Cruises Limited was already established by the time the Clements family assumed the mantle in the early part of the new millennium, the entrepreneurial skills of Richard, Judith, Jay and their team quickly elevated the entire operation to new levels. Such is serendipity, and through a combination of circumstances that found me in the right place at the right moment, I came to enjoy an association with the new owners for 7 seasons that I consider to be the pinnacle of my steerage career, and which led to personal friendships that continue to this day. Aided and abetted by a crew complement that naturally varied with the seasons, but which was at all times a model of fluency, the end result was a cumulative total of thousands of holidaymakers disembarking with a shedload of happy memories to take home and nothing but praise for the slickness of it all. Oft was this achieved under the most taxing of circumstances, not least when the infernal river flooded yet again or the boat was slewed by high winds buffeting its slab-sided superstructure. The height of the bridge at Worcester was the limiting factor in proceeding upstream, but Ollie's sheer bulk and dimensions offered something of a challenge to those few, including yours truly, who were privileged to coax, cajole and sometimes just brutally manhandle her around little teasers such as Purton Double Bridge on the Gloucester and Sharpness Canal, Globe Bend just north of Gloucester, the almost right-angled approach to Upper Load Lock and the near-implausible shimmy into Diglis Lock caused by the whole plot just being ever so slightly too big for the gates to shut simultaneously. Show her who was boss and she would respond magnificently. Treat her with disdain or indifference, and man, would she bite back hard. An unholy combination of soaring operational costs, swingeing regulations, and the increasingly parlous state of the river navigation caused a serious re-evaluation of the options for Ollie, and she was gracefully retired to rest in Gloucester whilst her future was contemplated. Ollie's smaller sibling, Edward Elgar, was constructed specifically to pass under Worcester Bridge and up to the head of navigation at Stourport. She continues where Oliver Cromwell leaves off and is a delightful, modern, purpose-built vessel, well up to the task. But there was no denying something special was lost with Cromwell's departure, and I will be grateful in perpetuity to the proprietors for allowing me to share in it initially as pilot and subsequently as captain before it all came to an end. Indeed, one of the most satisfying ticks on my CV is that I was the last to skipper her upriver before her retirement in 2009. The invitation from the proprietors to say a few valedictory words following her swansong cruise was an honour that even now I cannot begin to quantify. Here endeth my first sweet sorrow. But it was not all bad news, and plans that included a static facility based in or around Gloucester Docks, which were undergoing massive redevelopment, were formulated. Not so much a retirement as a moving on to pastures new, in a graceful transformation from a life of graft to a more genteel repose in which she could maintain her respect and stature without having to work quite so hard for it. Sadly, it was not to be, and after a period of struggling to realise her potential, she was put up for sale in 2012. And here we turn to the board again, for therein lies the rub. Selling the likes of Oliver Cromwell is multifaceted. All manner of ducks must line up in a row, including issues of finance, moorings availability, satisfactory surveys, and a panoply of other material to not only demonstrate that all is shipshape with the merchandise, but all is equally so with a prospective new owner. Then, when it's all sorted, comes the thorny issue of moving the vessel to its new home. I need not enlarge on what's involved here, other than to say it is a mammoth task. Thus, on Wednesday the 23rd of May 2018, did Oliver Cromwell set out from Gloucester under tow for her new home in Coleraine, Northern Ireland, when, 2 days later, on the afternoon of Friday the 25th, she foundered and went down in 50 metres of salty water. My second sweet sorrow. But this time, in the knowledge I could no longer entertain any hope of return, it was, as Kenneth Graham's Wind in the Willows, like summer tempests came his tears, and I confess that I was heartbroken. At the time of compiling my eulogy, the circumstances of Cromwell's demise are as yet unknown, but I am sufficiently familiar with the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency to know their inevitable inquiry will be scrupulous in establishing the facts. Mercifully, it was reported that no one was injured and there was no pollution, but this could not fully mitigate the indescribable sadness on viewing the brief video from the scene that appeared online shortly afterwards showing her slide bow first out of sight. All that's fair must fade, said Thomas More. Cold comfort when one is still yet to come to terms with Shakespeare's sweet sorrow of parting. So do please indulge me as, in the privacy of my own thoughts, I raise a glass in fondest memory of a much-loved and revered companion whose presence in my life, though brief, touched on it so profoundly. Farewell, Ollie, and thank you. But, I hear, though a rousing tale of a Black Country Waterways enthusiast's affair with a boat this may be, whither the Celtic connection? Well, having successfully negotiated over 200 nautical miles of crossing the briny towards her destination before catastrophe befell her, motor vessel Oliver Cromwell now lies forever in peace, about 12 miles to the west of South Stack Anglesey, in the very shadow of the Welsh coast. Enjoy your Black Country, and do join me again soon for more tales from the barn.
So that's it for another edition of the Black Country Talking News. A reminder to our CD listeners who have received CDs in padded envelopes that you don't need to send anything back to us. If you have a sight loss tip or someone you would like to wish a happy birthday to, just say hello to. Maybe even a poem or talking book you would like reviewed, then please get in touch with us at the Beacon Centre. Call 01902 880111. Email bctn@beaconvision.org or write to us at the Black Country Talking News, Beacon, Wolverhampton Road East, Wolverhampton, WV4 6AZ. We look forward to hearing from you. Thank you for listening, and thank you to all our supporters, donators and volunteers who, without their support, we would be unable to run this free service. Please note the information and views expressed in this recording does not necessarily represent the views of Beacon or Talking News and were accurate at the time of recording. Mentions of goods and services does not imply endorsement, and whilst every care is taken to supply accurate information, Beacon and Talking News do not undertake liability for any errors. So it's goodbye from all of us. Stay safe, have a good week, and we look forward to bringing you next week's edition of the Black Country Talking News. Ta-ra!